on ABC Local Radio, Radio Australia and the World Wide Web. This is Sunday Nights with John Cleary.
Hi there, thanks for joining us. Well, though we're buffeted by the edges of a major world recession, Australians, for the moment, still feel part of the lucky country, the land of the long weekend, where questions of ultimate value, meaning and purpose do not rate as barbecue stoppers. Even questions of more immediate interest, such as the fate of the planet, are only okay, it seems, so long as they offer no real impediment to lifestyle. Well, tonight, three young people join us to talk about their views of the world and where, if anywhere, questions of ultimate value and spirituality can find a place. And you could too can join the conversation. I'll give you the number shortly. In our second hour tonight, someone who knows the practical cost of commitment. He's the Reverend Peter Tibby, General Secretary of the Sudan Council of Churches, committed to peace and reconciliation in one of the most dangerous and violent regions of the planet. Driven by intercommunal, tribal and political violence seen over recent years, especially in the conflict in the Darfur region, Peter Tibby works at the grassroots for a renewed Sudanese society, one in which civil society takes precedence. He joins us in about an hour. Then there's the Inquisition, Noel Debien with another window on the long search for the good life, some music and your turn to talk in the chat room where Frank Sheehan will be our guest. Is Kevin Rudd playing us false with his ochreisms? That is, will the real Kevin Rudd please stand up? That's a question you might like to address in the chat room when you get your chance later on. This and any other commentary you care to offer with Frank Sheehan in a few hours' time. On Sunday night. Well, the financial crisis of the past few months raises questions the world has been ducking for years. Finding a new global ethic is just one of the critical values questions facing young people today, but how will those values be shaped? Is there a place for spirituality in a techno-driven, consumer-focused world? Well, joining us now are three young people who've spent some part of today with the Eremos Institute considering just those issues. Welcome to the studio, Carl and Chen, Stephanie Gessling, and Tim Karilowicz. Thank you very much for joining
us.
Thanks for having us.
Well, it's pretty big questions to thrust at a group on a Sunday afternoon. Stephanie, how did you come at it?
I just got a bunch of people together, basically, some of whom I knew, some of whom were recommended to me through friends or contacts. And everyone, when I got in touch with them, was actually, whoa, I don't know that I'm really the person to be speaking on this topic. The kind of overarching theme we went with was yearning for spiritual nourishment, and people were kind of like, oh, that's a big one. But everyone, I think, came at it from a perspective of what is my search and where have I been in my life that's kind of led to this.
Do you think that that is a question that can be asked today? I mean, in it, like publicly at uni or college or anywhere, do the big questions that have to do with anything other than how do we save the planet get asked? I mean, is it something you sort of go, well, yeah, that's all right, but, you know, I'd prefer a tinny or a latte.
Yes. I was a university student for about 6 years, and I found there were a lot of people who were asking those questions and a lot who weren't, so it really just kind of depended.
It's as it ever was, really. Yes. Yeah. Tim, why would you bother asking those questions? I mean, you know, why today would you accept an invitation to sit around and talk about those sorts of questions?
Well, I think we all have a desire to. We're all experiencing life. We all sit around at the end of the day and feel lonely, feel incredibly longing for a bigger picture. I think there's actually a deep attraction and longing to discuss these things. I'm not sure that in a university context, you necessarily want to talk about you want to hear about what an organized religion has to say about that. But I think we certainly will feel the longing for the answers to those questions.
And I suppose even in all subject areas, you're faced with these big moral questions and things that impact on your life and ways of looking at things that you haven't thought about before. And so I suppose university is a bit of a place for that, whether you make room for it to actually impact your life or whether you just go, oh, I know what answer I need to give to pass this assessment task is.
Right. What sets the ethical goalposts?
Carlin, let me come to you. It's almost as though the last 30 years or so, the period you've been growing up, that the ground has shifted in these debates. The default position used to be, well, people believe, and those who don't believe are the exception, and we need to, you know, question what they do. These days, the default position is basically unbelief or radical scepticism. So that the belief position is a position, or the spirituality position, is seen as something sort of odd, off there.
Yes, it is.
How did you grow up and shape these questions? Did you grow up in a conventional church environment?
I grew up going to a very conservative Chinese Presbyterian church, and then went to a slightly less conservative church for another 17 years after that, and then progressed on to a very different church where most of the people there were homeless or from public housing, with a few volunteers from the suburbs.
So what led you on that migration?
Yeah. Well, I think as in my teenage years, I had a much more conscious faith where it wasn't simply what was drummed into me or what I was just born into, but it was a conscious decision of mine to live my life for God. That sounds extremely corny. And it just happened that around that time as a teenager, somebody in my church encouraged us young people to get involved in a soup kitchen. And we discovered a little organisation in Woolloomooloo, which is now called Hope Street, and started volunteering with breakfasts once a month with homeless people. And I would say that that actually was a catalyst to completely changing my faith and spirituality.
What had it been and what did it become?
Okay, what it had been was very black and white, very aggressive and defensive and rules-based, and it's all about being a good girl, all about being, as I was saying earlier today, about being politely dishonest. Of course, that's not how anyone would say it, but
it's a good phrase.
I you know, was a very good student of polite dishonesty and still am to some degree, and it became much more grey. I realised that as much as I was told that we could have the answers, that actually we don't a lot of the time, and when you come into contact with people who've been marginalised and treated like crap in society, then they teach you very quickly that you do not have the answers to their life. it became a faith that actually had a concern for social justice, not just charity.
That it's something to do with this world.
Yeah, that's right. It's not just about pie in the sky when you die and getting everyone else there and telling everyone else that they're wrong and going to burn in hell, but it's actually about grace here.
Do you think those questions, and let me open this up, and Tim and Stephanie, get your views on this, these whole questions about the afterlife thing, the heaven and hell thing, have tended to become increasingly irrelevant for young people, even as what Carlin has said, seems to be saying that, look, if your religion matters, it's got to matter here, that spirituality has these days to really have something grounded about it.
I couldn't agree more. I've never thought of it as a young versus old people experience, but certainly I think all my life, the motive of you should become a Christian because, or so you'll get to go to heaven, has never cut any kind of mustard with me. I've always thought, well, what about tomorrow? How can I, if Jesus can't help me to live my life today, then I'm not sure that it really matters what happens after that. I don't know why that would have been any different for a previous generation.
100 years ago, people were sort of beaten into church by, you know, the fire and brimstone. If you don't do the right thing, you know, you're not going to have... It's an insurance policy for the afterlife. Yeah, yeah. Get this. Not the case today, Stephanie.
It's not something that's hugely impacted me. I'm not... I can't say that heaven and hell and images thereof are really a huge part of my life or my framework, and maybe they would be if I'd grown up somewhere different or, you know, had a real kind of yearning for justice if I'd been oppressed in some way. But me as I am, I'm really more into thinking about, yeah, the here and now and those kind of kingdom moments, or for want of a better word.
Yes, because what I'm getting to is, what is the centre of your spirituality? What is it that keeps you sort of saying, well, spirituality is relevant?
Yeah. You've got me. I'll get back to you.
Well, no, all right. Cut it.
For me, it's about hope. It's largely about hope, and is there anything to hope for? And I guess, you know, before you were saying at the beginning, you said, you know, are people asking any big questions apart from how to save the planet? I think how to save the planet is a hugely spiritual question, and you can't sustain your desire or your efforts to save the planet if you don't have a spirituality. Well, I think it's very difficult to, without burning out. I definitely find that for myself, and then if I don't keep finding that hope, then it would seem hopeless. I mean, for example, climate change is terrifying a lot of people and putting a lot of people into depression, I think. And I think a lot of reason why people are denying it is because it's too scary to think of it as true and real. But I feel that, you know, that people of faith should bring a message of hope to that climate change message, that, you know, we don't think, you know, we do believe there is hope, and we're going to work towards that, and that's why we work for justice and peace, because we do believe there's something better. And I guess, you know, Steph's talking about, well, what is heaven and hell? I think it's, you know, the traditional sort of pictures of heaven and hell, of, you know, angels on clouds and whatever, or it being a, you know, another realm, and hell being this dark place with, you know, devils running around or whatever. I that doesn't resonate with me as much, but I do think that, you know, all the images of God's kingdom that Jesus gave us are about heaven, but it's about it breaking in here and now. And those images were really radical and hard to understand. He talked about, you know, mustard seeds and yeast and things that don't sound like a kingdom at all. It just sounds like, you know.
Tim, what do you think of the whole heaven hell debate, and what's the centre of your spirituality?
Oh, well, the centre of my spirituality definitely, it comes back to and revolves around the person of Christ. And I absolutely agree with Carl, and I think Christ kind of embodies, I don't know, I guess he forms a picture for me of that puts the fuel in my desire to love my neighbour, and my desire to care for my garden, for my planet, for my friends, and for those people I meet and don't know. What is my spirituality revolve around? I guess it revolves around where's the hope and the love in this moment. And I see that in Christ.
Let me move on to another question that relates to you all. That is, and it touches on this sort of embodied nature of your spirituality. That is, it's got to have something connected to it. How important is it to be connected to a group of people who share that sense? And is that really part of the essence of it?
That's so important. A conversation like this, it fills everybody up, doesn't it? I mean, you kind of come away when you've discussed the existential questions, when you've seen someone renewed by a thought of hope, or it's fuel for the imagination. And
doesn't have to be people who share a belief system, or do you need that kind of fuel from people who you're walking alongside?
When I first moved to Sydney, I spent so many hours on the internet, and I think I found that I yearned so much to discuss questions of faith. But I think the best conversations always happen with people who came from a different framework. They helped me understand who I was. So, yeah, I agree with that.
I still think there is something really profound that happens when you meet with people who something aligns with between you and them in terms of conversation, in terms of where you're coming from, and that sense of being
people who don't share your comfort zone necessarily.
Well, yeah, or they do. I don't know. Yeah.
So they've come from somewhere else, but you have an aha moment.
Yeah, there could be that. Or I suppose journeying alongside people who share something of your faith, and you can learn and grow from each other through that common ground, I suppose. But still you come up against these moments of we're so not on par right now.
I guess ultimately we're all looking for soulmates, and sometimes those soulmates can be found in a group, and it's not a one-on-one thing. You can find 3 or 4, 5 or 6, 7 or 8, 9 or 10 people, and soon you've got a revolution that's going to change the world. That is going to stop global warming. That is going to change the planet. is that sort of hope thing? And I mean... there's a sense in which I am making a joke, but I'm not, in another sense. That the hope is found in you actually making connections.
Yeah. So I got when I moved to Sydney, I started at uni studying, and found a group that I really wanted to get more involved in, but studying part-time, it's so hard to find time to put into that kind of stuff. Eventually I managed to land a job, actually, working for the Uniting Church with a bunch of people who just got together for a lunchtime discussion group and just talk about the things that they're studying, how that fits with life and all the big questions and all that kind of stuff. That developed into getting a group of people together to say, hey, if we were to start a church or a congregation, what would that look like? What would we want to be part of? And together we started a little congregation in Epping called Space for God. And it was a bunch of people, bunch of misfits, really. So some from a Christian background, some who weren't, people who wanted to just get together and create a space that was safe to discuss the kind of things that you really don't know necessarily where you sit on, let alone where someone else is going to be coming from. And
it's often such a relief as well to come across a community like that. I know it can be stifling if you can't. If you feel that you're, you know, for instance, the church community that you've always grown up in, or the, you know, if you're in the university Christian club or whatever, and there's not permission to have those conversations that you're interested in, the climate change conversation or the, I don't know what.
Yeah.
I think when you get lucky and you come across someone like that,
yeah,
a Space for God or whatever, it's amazing.
Space for God, Stephanie, is a group that you've found meaningful. Does it continue?
It does continue.
So you've still got your little Epping group?
It's a small group. I'm no longer part of it. I've actually started working for Cafe Church in Glebe, which is a Uniting Church, similar kind of bunch of people a bit further along the road. They've been around for about 12 years, and I've just come from there tonight, actually. We have a BYO night every now and again where people bring along their own questions and discussion topics and throw it into the mix anonymously and see what people think. So, yeah, kind of a space where it's maybe not quite as traditionally churchy as you might expect. And for some people that's really confronting, to come to a church where it's not what you would expect. For other people it's incredibly life-giving, and it's a real breathe out kind of moment to be able to be yourself and be vulnerable.
Tim, what sort of group are you involved with?
I work for Hope Street, who Carla mentioned before, that work down in Woolloomooloo, amongst the public housing estate. They also do a bit of work with the homeless. I coordinate their education programs, so I get to take groups down and sleep out and experience homelessness on the street, experience what it is to receive charity. We go and line up at the food vans along with everybody else, and then have a cold night in the streets, and we usually end up going to Brekkie Church in the morning and get to feel what it's like to sit through church after a night in the concrete.
All of you are talking to me about the sort of church which essentially is not, in the first instance, about doctrine. It's not about right belief. Would you say that's a that is a generally shared sense among people today, that really church no longer is about, you know, conforming to the correct set of beliefs and signing on the dotted line. It's really about where you're at.
There are plenty of churches that are about doctrine.
Yeah, yes. What,
and there's plenty of young people that are on about doctrine too.
That's right. I worship at an Anglican church, which you know, we say every week, I believe, and we say the Apostles' Creed, and I think it's almost the centerpiece of the church service. Personally, I find it, I die inside every time I have to say it.
Because it resonates with what Carlin, you said earlier. What was that word you used, the phrase you used? Oh. Polite hypocrisy?
Polite dishonesty.
Polite dishonesty.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
Because we have trouble with those really hard edges. Would you generally say that these days, that people have trouble with hard edge?
Yeah, it's that, but also I guess what frustrates me is also that communities of faith and churches should be places of honest relationships and genuine connection with each other, but usually that really comes down to a polite cup of tea after the service, and that's the depth of engagement that you get.
There's something else that links to that, and it goes back to the bigger questions, that is how you get people to take seriously the questions of the environment or whatever. And people are saying, look, the church has got a great opportunity to actually take this on. Yet, Cullen, from what you say, that whilst religion and Christianity are seen as grappling with some of these issues at the deepest level, the ordinary concerns of a conventional congregation, largely these days middle class, don't engage at this level. I mean, it's more about therapeutic comfort than it is about revolutionary change.
Right, absolutely. I worship in Surrey Hills, and they've just built a new community centre, and I love the I sort of love to hate the irony that we've got this community centre which is packed and busy 6.5 days a week, and I worship at a church 200 metres down the road, which is empty those 6.5 days a week and full for the half day a week that the community centre's shut. It seems like such an obvious, logical thing that we could sell the building and move where the community is. But I think that's out of the question of the where this particular parish council will be deliberating upon in the near future.
I think things are changing, and I guess with the work that I'm involved with, where we are trying to mobilise Christians to speak up about justice for the poor and the marginalised, over the last few years, churches have spoken up like never before in Australia, and even federal politicians are recognising that, and that's really exciting. But I think it, because the institutional church is an institution, then that change happens a lot more slowly and with a lot more politics involved.
A difficult question. You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio Around Australia. John Cleary with you. My guest, Carlin Chen, Stephanie Gessling, and Tim Kirilowicz. And we're talking about spiritual yearning and young people. What are the big issues facing young people who want to keep spiritually engaged today? What are the challenges presented by the church? What are the challenges confronting young people in society? What are the challenges for the future? You may want to join the conversation, ask some questions, give us some opinions. 1-300-800-222. 1-300-800-222 is the number to give us a call if you'd like to talk to a group of young people who spent today under the auspice of the Eremos Institute in Sydney discussing some of the big questions facing people today. Let's talk about one or two of those big issues that you dealt with today. Stephanie, how would you describe the issues that were dealt with and the sort of priority people gave them?
I suppose for me, I was really interested in some of the contrasts that came up in the discussion. So there was a few people mentioned the idea of solitude and but then also finding God in community, and what's the kind of where's the balance there, I suppose, was one interesting thing. And when you're talking about young people, I suppose one of the big issues that young people face and that all people face in our society is mental health issues, and particularly depression. So that's something we talked a little bit about as well, is just how each of us have managed to where we've kind of pulled strength from during those really dark times. Yeah.
What for you were the most significant things to come out of the conversation, Carlin?
Yeah, that's a good question. I have to think about that one. I think, yeah, that I guess from what the audience pointed out, that a lot of us had grown up in that, you know, traditional church setting and then sort of, I guess, found our own way outside of that, and some of us had wandered back or found a different way. So, yeah, it was interesting. And then the question was raised, you know, what would we then say for the next generation? Would we raise our children to go through those same traditions we went through? Mm. You know, would we, if we could turn back time, would we have not put ourselves through that? Yeah, which is quite interesting, I think.
And that is a big question. Tim, did you have any response to that? I mean, would you wish your kids to go through what you went through?
That's right. Oh, the torment of being raised. I was raised as a Pentecostal, so I thank the church I grew up in for giving me the most positive attitude to life in the world. I think we are, in a way, we all have, all five of us panelists grew up with the privilege of being raised in a very strong, with a very strong sense of who we are and a strong sense of identity.
And you wouldn't trade that off?
Well, I wouldn't know what it would be like.
I might.
I think you're grateful for it in parts.
Yeah, it's funny, Carlin, isn't it?
Yes.
So isn't that interesting? We all look back and we get to a point where we say, look, I moved away from that. I broke from it. I broke from that which shaped me, but I am intensely grateful for some aspects of it.
Some aspects.
What are the bits,
that,
Carlin?
I'm grateful, yes, for? I'm grateful for some expressions of community that were healthy. I guess by that I'm implying that there were some aspects that were unhealthy. I'm grateful for people that nurtured me and, yeah, took a very genuine interest in my well-being as a person.
Yes, they gave you a secure social world as a child. I think that's one of the most significant things, isn't it? You have a world that you can move in safely, that your parents, you know, your parents aren't your only locus.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, because I think that kind of community is very rare, particularly today in Australian society. So communities of faith have a great opportunity to provide that. Yeah.
And the unfortunate byproduct of that is you get raised in a way that almost insulates
from hearing other points of view.
Makes it very difficult to kind of come out. It's a coming out, isn't it? When you
the other thing I'm actually really grateful for, as I know we sort of said, oh, it's not all about doctrine, and like for me, life's not all about doctrine. But I am actually really grateful for people that were passionate about the Bible.
That gave you solid study, an intellectual frame.
Yeah, yes. Because that does really still drive who I am now and why I do it, and gives me that solid basis. But for me, it's, you know, how I read those is much less black and white, and I'm much...
But the rigour is still there.
Yeah, definitely. Yes. I think, like, for me, that is, yeah, what, you know, keeps me centred. Yeah.
Stephanie, for you.
I'm probably from a less conservative background than these guys. My mum jokes that she raised me a Christian socialist. And
well, it had its own sense of rigour about it.
Yeah, I suppose it does. And in some ways I've struggled with the opposite thing with, well, am I too progressive, and where does my faith lie if not in the text and if not in...
So either the experience or the text.
The experience or the text. I wouldn't want to say one or
the
other.
Or the institution.
But I suppose I'm still very much, I've grown up with the stories, and the stories and other people's experiences have really shaped my faith, and I'm really grateful for that.
Let's take a couple of calls. We've got some calls on the board. We'll take one from Peter in Tasmania. Hello, Peter. Welcome. What would you like to say?
Good evening.
Good evening.
Yeah, so I haven't been in on the conversation here for too long, or listening, I should say, but I got the idea that many people out there must have different views of what the church is, and probably a lot of reading from the prophecies about Christ coming and then his fulfillment of it would be in order to understand that Jesus didn't come to be a social movement or a political movement or for anyone's fancy, whatever they might pick, whatever the work of the church that they're involved in wants to do. He came to seek and save the lost, and that was purely his reason for coming here.
What do you mean by that phrase, though? Seek and save the lost. It's the phrase, isn't it, that's the key?
And what did enlighten, Jesus mean by that? To enlighten mankind about his sinful nature and bring him back to God.
And what do we know? What's the sinful nature?
Well, man is, if you like, by nature sinful.
Yes, but how does that manifest itself?
Without getting into that conversation, I'd just like to contrast that with what was said, what I heard said, and
yep.
You know that it's good that some churches nowadays speaking out about social issues and things. I mean, that's sure we can do that as individuals, but as the work of the church to spend money, you know, on social issues, Jesus didn't come to feed hungry people or to, you know, bandage their physical wounds, but he came to as a spiritual doctor, if you like. He came to heal them spiritually, to heal us spiritually.
Carlin, you wanted to say something on that.
Yeah, thanks, Peter, for your question. I guess my understanding of Scripture doesn't match up with that. And if you look at Luke 4:18, where Jesus basically gives his mission statement, he goes into the synagogue. It's his very first statement after he's done his 40 days of fasting. He's going into ministry. He reads out a prophecy from Isaiah. And I'm sorry, I can't recite it word for word, but he basically says, "The Spirit of the Lord is on me. He's anointed me to preach good news for the poor, freedom for the oppressed, sight for the blind." And to me, those are not just spiritual things. And that is not the only time that he says that or behaves that way, in fact. And it's not just that statement or Jesus' life. It's throughout the whole scriptures from the very beginning of the Old Testament through the prophets. And even Paul himself made sure that the church was concerned about equality, and he spoke up to authorities as well. And if you read the prophets of the Old Testament, they existed to keep the kings accountable when they were oppressing the poor, and they existed to keep God's people accountable when they weren't speaking up for justice for the poor, as well as when they were straying from worshipping God. So I think I understand where you're coming from, because that's exactly the message that I was brought up to believe, but I actually don't think that's a scriptural interpretation.
Yes, I can see that, you know, when I make the comment that people might take it one-sided too far, and I know Jesus, he never left anybody lying there in the gutter. I mean, there were plenty of circumstances where he was the first one to help out. He was never frightened to help out. But on the other hand, when Peter defended him and cut off the ear of the Roman soldier, Jesus said, you know, I can't remember whether it was right then, but he had made it plain in other places that he didn't come to bear the sword.
Yeah, well, he also said his kingdom was not of this world.
Kingdom, a good one too, that his kingdom wasn't of this world. And I know that in his walk through life, he generally took care of all those around about him as much as we could. And obviously that's laid on all of us. That's obviously goes without saying. But I'm saying the movement of the church generally is not a physical one. It's a spiritual one, and we can get sidetracked with all these other issues where, you know, really we don't need a public building. The public building is not the church. It's the body of Jesus Christ, which is the people.
Mm.
Just starting with that one thing, the buildings that we could spend lots and lots of money on, you know, we don't need that, and we don't need to invest money in all the problems in our society, and we need to get the word to people and try and help them understand.
Peter, we're going to have to move on. Thanks for your observations.
Thank you.
Might just get Tim also to just comment on what Peter had to say there, Tim.
It's funny, isn't it? It's sort of the perennial question, to be social or to be spiritual, and I'd like to dedicate my time 50-50 to the two great commandments. I want to love God and I want to love my neighbour. So I'm happy to go with Peter. I'll go 50-50 with you.
And indeed, one could actually see it, if you wanted to see it in philosophical terms, as a spiritual worldview has to have an ethical outlook,
right?
Expressed in its practical ethics.
Unless you're planning on becoming a hermit, which I'm sure is amazing. I don't know what I'm supposed to do if I'm just waiting for what next.
There's one other question, Tim, while we've got you on this subject. You say you grew up in a Pentecostal church, and the Pentecostal church has very strong emphasis.
Oh, absolutely.
On you know, getting people into the heavenly lifeboat.
Right.
And for some people, the worship experience is what it's all about. That's where that's the culmination of it all,
and
the
more.
Worship experience.
That's why we sell it on CDs. It's Faith for $29.95. I won't say which website to go to get it. It's funny, and I think the deepest irony of that is that now I'm in an Anglican church, which is so similar to that, and personally I have my disagreements with that emphasis, but I love that both the Pentecostals and my Anglican brothers and sisters have always considered their expression to be about as close as it comes, and always swung quite a few swings at the other mob. So I find that kind of funny.
But for you, it's not that the act of worship isn't ultimate what it's all about. Ultimately, the act of worship is supposed to be an impetus to something else.
Oh, I could talk all day about worship. I believe worship should be our rehearsal space. It should be as I was saying before, where our imaginations are enlivened.
Yeah, there you
That'll
go.
That'll do.
to live the lives that Christ would have us live.
Yeah, a place to experiment, I suppose, with the everyday and with the bigger picture stuff as well. And
the mystery of the mysteries of our faith are wonderful and divine. And I think it's I feel like I've just been given permission so recently to play in that and explore that.
And I suppose that's where I take issue with what our last caller was saying, is that idea that Jesus came to tell us all what terrible people we are, scum of the earth, all of that stuff. I really just, for me, Jesus is so much there to help us be who we are and express our humanity.
Although I could contrast that with the recent remark by somebody talking about Barack Obama's favourite theologian. There's a guy called Reinhold Niebuhr, who's famous for saying that the one biblical truth or doctrine of the truth, the one doctrine of the church that is empirically provable is original sin. Partly tongue-in-cheek, only partly tongue-in-cheek. Let's take another call. Let's go to Toby. Hello, Toby. Welcome. What would you like to say?
Good evening. I was wondering what your panellists have to say on how error-free the Bible is.
How error-free the Bible is?
Yes.
Here's a question you should be asking a bunch of professional theologians. we'll all take a punt at that. Well, Stephanie, we'll start with you this time.
I reckon I'm of the belief that the Bible is an amazing collection of stories written by a whole bunch of people who lived a really long time ago. And so, yeah, I suppose error-free or not, I'd say, yeah, if you're talking about in terms of fact and error in really black and white terms, then sure, there's error. If you're talking about error as something being wrong, I don't know that I'd go so far as to say that.
Yes, factual error and spiritual truth can be two different things, can't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, I suppose the way that we interpret and the way that we let those stories infuse our lives and the way that we understand the context in which they were written and the way that might affect our reading of them today are all, yeah, things that I'd want to take into account when thinking through those issues.
Carolyn?
I think, I mean, the Bible is not one book. It's many, many books, and you know, a whole lot of those books are poems. I mean, it, you know, how can you ask of a fiction novel, is it error free? If it's, you know, a bunch of poems are people's way of, you know, the Psalms, for example, were people's way of expressing their worship to God, which was, you know, some people's perspective, and I guess the Proverbs were some people's way of putting what, you know, God's wisdom into a nutshell. And the Gospels, the reason why we have four of them is because four different people had different perspectives of their first-hand eyewitness of Jesus' life. And
some contain bits that others don't, exactly. And sometimes the time frames are not consistent.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I think error-free, I find that a difficult question to answer because it's full of different kinds of...
Inspired by God?
Alexa, yeah, that's a separate question. Yeah. Go,
yeah,
Carolyn?
That would lead on is to that, it being error-free because it's been inspired by God through the hands of the writers.
I think that even if people can be inspired by God in what they say, they can still, you know, you can be inspired by God and still make mistakes.
Yep. Tim?
These guys are great. I was... I'm only saying this so that everyone thinks I'm really clever, but I was reading a little page out of a book by Derrida today.
And
And Derrida said, he talks about the horror that it must have been to be Jeremiah, for God to say, now mark down my words, mark them all, mark them clearly. Off you go. And, you know, blasting out 50 pages of prophecy. And he talks about the absolute blinding terror that it must be to have thrust upon you the task of writing and revealing
the truth of God.
The truth of God. So I feel a certain empathy for the writers of the Bible. I do believe there's something divine in the Bible, absolutely. But I don't know that I don't know that the question of is it factually
inerrant.
Right. Yeah. Inerrant. I'm not sure if that's a question.
Toby, why is that a question of importance for you?
Oh, it's especially important because I'm very into the creation evolution question.
Right, so am I.
Why does it matter, the process by which God used to bring life into the world?
Because evolution is a process which uses death to bring life into the world.
That's nonsense. Quite frankly, I mean, evolution is a biological process. He hung up.
That's a shame.
Since me being silly and grumpy, I wasn't disagreeing with the right to argue. I was giving an opinion there. All right, Toby. Let's talk about that for a moment, because that has become a stick by which people beat other people. It seems as though we've moved away from questions of doctrine as the sort of mainstream deciding line in the church these days. And it comes down to ethical issues like where you stand on abortion, where you stand on gay rights, and where you stand on creation versus evolution.
That's right.
I don't see any of these discussed in any great detail as a matter of salvation in the Bible. So,
and interestingly, not often preached about either. Directly from the pulpit. You guys are looking at me like you disagree. I've never heard it preached. I think it's one that in my community we're expected to have absorbed the
perspective
by
DNA.
Osmosis. No one's going to tell us that we should all be creationists. But you know, if you mention that you disagree, you think intelligent design's a load of rubbish. you get given this funny look.
Carlin.
So what was the question again?
Yeah,
I was listening. I just got...
Well, it's to do with the whole way in which it seems that these days questions of orthodoxy seem to be related not so much to sort of traditional issues of doctrine and theology, like we were talking about, but your opinion on several issues, including creation and evolution.
Yeah. I think a lot of it is to do with fear, actually, that we're scared that if we don't have the answer, then, you know, the world will go out of control and who knows what, all hell will break loose. And if we believe in creation, or if we, you know, believe that it's okay to be homosexual or whatever. To be honest, I don't know. I think as I grew up, I was probably more interested in those questions and debating them, but without any concept of what the real world was like. It was all a theoretical argument and about being right and being able to shove the right answer down someone's throat. I know there are some genuine concerns, for example, in the abortion debate, but I think we get overly hung up on these issues that press our buttons for some reason, but I think that it comes down to our own fear about uncertainties. And
there are identity issues too, because the position you take defines who you are instantly.
And what group you're allowed to be a member of.
So it's an allegiance thing, I think.
Yes.
Yeah, definitely.
And do you think Stephanie, that there's an element with these debates about social definition?
I do, and I suppose I'm of the belief that unless you're directly experiencing one of these issues on a personal level, then, like, I think it's okay to take a particular standpoint and to argue it. I think that's great to do that and to get together with other people who are like-minded or who think differently and to have these debates. But at the same time, if you're speaking from a point of ignorance, of really not ever having experienced what it's like to be in that situation, then what are you talking about?
Yes, and none of those questions are going to define you in or out of the kingdom of God.
What do you mean by that?
In some people's opinions, they would.
You would say they would?
I wouldn't say they would, but I know that there are many people out there who would say that if you believe this, you are not a Christian or you're going to hell or whatever, for sure.
Yeah, I've got used to that. That's okay.
So it seems to me that on the creation evolution thing, that is a debate that simmers below the surface in the whole climate change debate. And that debate could be the most important debate that any of us have in our lifetimes.
And I think also the debate at the other end of what we believe about heaven and hell, I think also impacts on the climate change debate.
It does, doesn't it?
Because if you believe that this world is just going to burn and Jesus will come back when this world has finished burning, then, hey, let's all get in there and burn it sooner so Jesus will come back sooner. And, I mean, that's a really appalling way to express it, but I think that it is actually quite a mainstream.
Yeah, why polish the brass on a sinking ship?
But doesn't that mean for all of you that as much as you are committed to helping the poor and dispossessed and doing that, there's a job to be done inside the churches too about attitudinal stuff?
Absolutely.
And the way the Bible is read and understood?
That's where it starts.
I think it's more than just the way the Bible's read and understood too. It's the way that we approach knowledge.
And relationships. The way we relate to each other.
Big tasks. We've got about a minute to go. Are we optimistic about facing this sort of agenda?
Yeah,
Where do you want to be in 10 years' time, Steph?
Wow. That's not my favourite question. I want to be old and wise. I hope I'm on my way. Yeah.
All right, Tim, where do you want to be?
I hope... I'm with Steph. With a few more wrinkles on the face and hopefully I can play an instrument.
Carlin?
I would like to be living more honestly.
Avoiding the polite hypocrisy that you, or polite dishonesty that you brought into this conversation. Yeah. Thank you very much for your honesty, all of you. You're on Sunday Night. Thanks to Carlin Chen, Stephanie Gessling and Tim Kirilovich. Back soon with a journey to the Sudan.